Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Earlier this year, I was tying up grapevines in my backyard using zip ties. Zip ties, very clever little devices. Last year's zip ties were still clinging to the grapevine trellis, so I took a little moment while performing my task this year to snip off the old ones and stick them in my pocket. I was thinking that was a smart thing to do because radiation from the sun turns these plastic things brittle, and then little bits of debris would fall in the ground and get lost in the soil. I didn't want that to happen. I have feelings about that. So I kept them in my pocket, and then later I sent them out with the garbage to some distant location. I know not where, but presumably there's a place for old zip ties to go and die. Right now on Constant Wonder, we are going to be talking about other odds and ends that belong to this category of detritus. Detritus, just a fancy Latin word for junk, loosely speaking. But somehow it feels a little bit more noble, you know, when you use the Latin. Zip ties could one day be somebody else's problem once you let them out of your sight. Or they might be a lot of fun for some archaeologist digging through a landfill, or maybe even finding them elsewhere. We are actually going to be talking about, yes, junk, but space junk. And there is a tie-in with zip ties in this conversation. Dr. Space Junk will be joining with us. She was one of the very first people to pursue the study of what has come to be called space archaeology. Alice Gorman, an internationally recognized leader in this field. Dr. Space Junk, not her formal title, I should say. She is a faculty member of the International Space University's Southern Hemisphere Space Program in Australia and Adelaide, and she's author of Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, Archaeology and the Future. Alice Gorman, welcome to our show.
Hello, Marcus.
So I brought up zip ties, and that's going to sound very curious to probably anybody except you, and you will understand where I'm going. Do you have a fondness for zip ties?
I would say it probably goes beyond a fondness to almost an obsession with zip ties, and most of my friends and colleagues are quite tired of me picking them up in the street, having them fall out of my pencil case, and bringing them up at any possible relevant opportunity. But for me, they're an incredibly fascinating object because they're mass-produced, they're mass-disposed of exactly in the way you were describing with your grapevines. And people just use them and don't think much about them. They're just like a background object. But they were invented at the beginning of the space age for aerospace industry, and there are now zip ties everywhere from under the soil where, you know, they've fallen and become covered up and become an archaeological deposit, to Earth orbit, to Mars, and on spacecraft that are winging their way towards the outer reaches of the solar system. So the zip tie is one of the most versatile and widely distributed human artifacts ever made.
When I think about space junk, and if I think about zip ties in conjunction with space junk, would there be a random zip tie out there in space orbiting the Earth, or would it be connected to something?
Well, frequently when crew members on the International Space Station have to do outside maintenance, there are zip ties holding things together on the outside of the International Space Station. So they have to go and replace them, and they often cut them off and they are released and go out to become little bits of space junk by themselves. But they are, of course, in low Earth orbit, and objects in low Earth orbit, which extends from sort of the end of the atmosphere to about 2,000 kilometres, but with the International Space Station, it's about 400 kilometres high. So it gets pulled back into the atmosphere pretty quickly. But of course, it's an intense radiation environment out there. And unlike your grapevine zip ties, the ones used on the International Space Station are made of a patented radiation-resistant material, but they're still not going to last forever. So they will become brittle and fall into bits as well if they don't get dragged into the atmosphere. So the ones that are actually used internally on spacecraft or on spacecraft that are in, you know, safer regions of space might last a bit longer. And of course, that's the intention. The whole point of a zip tie is to keep things together, is to stop them from becoming separated, which is such a simple human function, fastening things together, that we've taken into this robotic realm in outer space.
Well, with all this talk about zip ties up there, did your obsession begin with zip ties down here?
Yes, it did. Sadly, as a space archaeologist, it's not within my capacity to actually do any archaeology in space. But there are plenty of places on Earth that you can call space archaeology too. So some years back, I decided to do an archaeological survey at the Auroral Valley NASA tracking station in Australia. It's just outside Canberra. And this was operating for about 20 years, 1965 to 1985, to track low Earth orbit spacecraft. And it was set up by NASA and owned by NASA, but run by Australians. And when they decommissioned it, they basically razed everything to the ground. So there were just the concrete footings of buildings and various things left over. And because of this, when I went to do my survey, I started thinking about what was under the ground, because so much of the above ground infrastructure was gone. So this got me thinking about cables and their importance in the space age, which kind of coincides with the growth of computing. So you have all kinds of cables, you know, ones for data, ones for electricity, and all of the antennas that communicate with spacecraft are just full of cables. So at this site, I realized that there was still a lot of intact cabling underground, and this is part of the archaeological record of the space age too. So cables naturally led to cable ties, zip ties, which I then found with my student team littered all over the surface of this site. And we think they had been discarded when the site was decommissioned and they took down these, you know, these massive antennas and took them to other places. And I started to see them as each one is kind of the record of a series of human actions. So attaching them to the cables and the infrastructure and then detaching them as the larger, heavier objects kind of moved around and were taken to other places in the landscape. This is where the obsession came from. The other thing I think that really drew me to the zip tie, so when I was doing this work, I realized I had no idea where they came from, like how long they'd been around. Were they first made in the 1800s when electricity started to be introduced to places around the world? Were they recent? I just had no idea. So, of course, leapt onto the internet and started researching. And the thing that I love about this is the zip tie was invented by one person, an engineer, electrical engineer called Morris C. Logan. And he didn't invent it because he saw a problem with how people were doing their electrical cabling. He invented it because he went to visit a Boeing aircraft factory where the workers were using waxed string to bundle the cables for an aircraft together. And, of course, tension is really important when you're doing this. And the wax string was destroying their hands. They had an expression for it. They called it hamburger hands. So the constant, drawing this string together to get it to the right tension cut their fingers. They had multiple blisters. Their hands were a mess. And Morris C. Logan looked at their hands and he thought, there's got to be a better way. So he went away and invented the zip tie. And I just love that that story is about a human experience, not just about technology.
Exactly. That's what I think is so fascinating about the work that you do, is that you tie this material. It doesn't just float out there without a story that's a human story. And you just demonstrated that this goes back to a human need, actually some human suffering at some level, right?
Yeah, I mean, it cannot have been pleasant to have to constantly, destroy your hands. And the whole embodiment of this process, I think, is so important. I love that such a simple invention. Of course, I should add that lots of people still use waxed string for this because cable ties aren't the best option all the time. But, yeah, it's kind of, here's this little small thing that you can do just to make the lives of some frontline workers in the aircraft industry a little bit better.
So I'm thinking about this term space junk. It sounds to me that your purview is beyond just space junk. You're also going after space age junk, that artifacts that could be anywhere on the soil, under the soil, or on its way to Pluto.
Zip ties, again, I think there's other artifacts like this too, but it's extraordinary that they cross Earth and space. So they perform the same function, and they're versatile enough and useful enough to be, you know, such a common object that people have them around their houses, in their kitchens, in their cars, in their garages on Earth. And they're also so far away in space too. So they're kind of invariant across different gravity conditions and across different radiation conditions. And I don't think there are too many objects like that. Another one that I love, and I think you can probably see how that kind of arises from the zip tie thing, is Ziploc plastic bags.
Right.
So they're one of the most versatile and frequently used artifacts on the International Space Station. And they're similar in the sense, you know, they're a bit of plastic that is made in huge quantities. Again, people on Earth will have Ziploc bags in their kitchens. We use them in archaeology. We use them on an excavation to put artifacts in and label them so we can store them and retrieve them exactly as we need to in the artifact analysis. And so that they exist between Earth and space as well. Although I have to say, a Ziploc bag isn't radiation hardened, and you won't find it on the outside. It wouldn't last long on the outside. So it seems to me there's something interesting about the kinds of objects that stay the same no matter what context they're in Earth or space. And there's probably other ones as well, but because I'm so obsessed with zip ties and Ziploc plastic bags, I've tended to focus on them.
Well, I just want to take the Ziploc bag and the zip ties and make a comment here and see if I can just get a reaction from you. Those are such humble little things. They're so commonplace, as you've mentioned. And there's something about normalizing these things. It's kind of weird that we humans do this. Now, this normalization business of what is really quite extraordinary. There's a passage in your book. This comes from the chapter Junkyard Earth, and you open the chapter saying, "You can buy a packet of space food sticks from the supermarket, hold your phone in your hand and walk in the directions a satellite beams down to you. You can take your kids to play in the rocket park. Museums and science centers often have models and simulations of spacecraft, sometimes even unflown real ones. These are still dead spacecraft, safe to approach and touch, just like the reconstructed skeletons of ferocious dinosaurs now frozen into meekness. These museum spacecraft are not in their natural habitat, though. And there's no equivalent of a safari park to watch them in the wild. We can't observe them working. We only know they are there by the effects they cause, such as sending television signals. Equally, we don't see them die, decompose, and become junk." And as I was reading that, it just occurred to me that all of this space stuff, to call any of it commonplace, even the zip tie, isn't that kind of weird that we normalize this?
I guess it is. When you think what these objects are, it is extraordinary. We see them in different kinds of representations on Earth, and we just think, you know, there's stuff out there in space doing whatever, particularly, I guess, when using our smartphones, which almost everybody across the world does these days. We don't even think about how they're connected to things in space above our heads. It's kind of easy to forget that these objects facilitating all of this stuff are extraordinary feats of engineering and technology and ingenuity. There's a weird kind of thing, I think, where some of this stuff is so familiar and so part of our everyday lives that we forget it. But then when something brings it to our attention, like going to see a spacecraft in the museum, then we think about it, but we don't necessarily think about it as something we're connected to. Archaeologists are often the people who are responsible for cultural heritage management. That's all about connections to people and communities. And there's a question that's constantly raised. When I tell people that I work in space, this is often mentioned. They say, you know, why are we spending all this money on these incredibly expensive spacecraft when there are so many problems to solve here on Earth? And because people often don't think about them a lot, because they are sort of so normalized and invisible in many ways in how they operate in our daily lives, there's also, I guess, a great lack of awareness of just how dependent we are on stuff in space. I think a lot of people now are aware that we have a problem in Earth orbit and we could be heading for quite a bad catastrophic situation where there are too many collisions for people to go into space anymore or to send new missions into space. But calling it junk, implying that it's all the same and that it's all discarded and valueless, to me, first of all, I don't think it's true because there's so much variation and so many different kinds of things up there. But some of those things are connected to people and communities. There are all these incredible stories about objects that are now called space junk that a lot of people haven't heard or aren't aware of. And I think looking at space junk from a heritage perspective brings some of these stories to the fore and gives people additional reasons to feel connected to space. And I think that's important.
Yet to come, we've got to find out why Dr. Space Junk, a.k.a. Alice Gorman, would have anything to say about the moon and bird migration in conjunction with a book on space junk. Alice Gorman is with us. Her book is titled Dr. Space Junk versus the Universe, Archaeology and the Future. She's an internationally recognized leader in the field of space archaeology. Alice Gorman, you were talking about the things that are invisible to us here on Earth that are really connected with space, the idea that we use a smartphone maybe and don't even think about the fact that all the data and the GPS and who knows what else is connected to satellites and ultimately to space junk as well. There's another kind of invisibility that you kind of talk about in your book, which has to do with you're studying stuff that sometimes is so small, it can't be seen telescopically.
You're referring, I guess, to the archaeological sites on the moon.
On the moon or something that has spun out past Saturn, past Jupiter on its way out?
This is true. So most human-made space objects, even when they're in low Earth orbit, you have to have good telescopes or very fancy cameras to take photographs of them a few hundred kilometers above the Earth. So most of the stuff that we've sent out there, we can't see. I mean, a lot of it is sending signals back to us, so we know where it is, and we sometimes know something about the environment that it's traveling through or the environment that it's situated in on the surface of another planetary body. And in the case of places like the Moon and Mars, we do have orbiting spacecraft that can send us back images of what's happening on the surface. But we can't see them close up, not at this stage anyway. So I guess that's true. A lot of space archaeology is looking at things that, in fact, we can't see very well at all. And it's a little bit counterintuitive because probably when most people think of archaeology, they think about excavation, which is something that archaeologists do. And excavation is very physical, like it's hard physical work. And you have to use your hands and your body and you get dirty and you excavate objects and structures and buildings that are at a human scale. So they're made for other humans. But when we're looking at stuff in space, a lot of it is robots. And a lot of it is sort of beyond human scales, in a sense. So it's quite a disembodied archaeology. And to me, the visualizing these things, I think, is an important way of helping people feel connected to them. But figuring out what they look like, what they look like now, and the environments they're in is sort of in the way that we might think of an Earth landscape, is often relying on documents or remote sensing data or on these little signals that they send back that give us information about their environment. But we haven't actually seen them. So we haven't seen Voyager 1 or 2, which are the furthest objects from Earth at the moment, since 1977 when they were launched. We don't know what they look like now. We can only make theories about how they've fared as they've traveled through the environment of the solar system. The fact that they're still working suggests that they're not too destroyed, But you think of the lovely shiny surfaces that these spacecraft left Earth with. And now after, 1977, it's going to be up to 50 years since they've been in space. So constantly bombarded by little micrometeorites and particles of their surface flaking off because the radiation has weakened the materials. So they're probably looking not shiny at all, quite tarnished and shabby. But of course, I can only use the data that we have to kind of imagine in my mind what Voyager 1 and 2 and other spacecraft like them actually look like now, what this means in terms of the passing of time, I guess.
Does it seem ever daunting that these irretrievable objects, and it might not have to be out of our solar system even, it might be something that has gone to Venus and landed there as some kind of a probe, but it's enshrouded now with all the mist and vapor of Venus. Is it a little bit daunting to think that those things are so far away and irretrievable that they might have slipped out of the purview of your discipline of space archaeology?
Yes, that's an interesting question. I think one of the interesting things about this is the way aerospace engineers tend to think is once a mission is officially over, then that's kind of it. You know, you move on to other projects and you stop thinking about that old thing. But of course, it's the reverse for an archaeologist. So one of the things that my colleagues and I do is seek out these objects that seem to have been forgotten by mainstream space science. And of course, heritage is becoming a much bigger issue in space at the moment. People are starting to sort of say, oh, this stuff might actually be really significant. So for me, remembering some of these spacecraft or the process of researching some of these spacecraft is a kind of a process of remembering them and retrieving them from the junk pile of memory. And you mentioned Venus, and that's one of my, it's my second favorite planet. And there is a lot of Russian stuff so that's still on the surface and, in my opinion, probably has survived reasonably well. And for a long, long time, well, the idea was, well, we're never going back to the surface. We're never going to see these things again, even if they do still exist. So we might as well forget about them. There's nothing we can do with them. And in the last few years, interestingly, we've had a number of new missions planned for Venus, and they're all orbiting missions. Like, nobody's going back to the surface immediately, and they're probably not going to be able to image them either because the cloud decks of Venus are pretty thick. But somebody will get back down to the surface one day, and it would be interesting and useful to locate one of the Russian Venera missions just to see what the impact of Now, I'm going to get this wrong. There's so many ways of using Venus as an adjective. Venusian, Venerian, Venetian. No, that's the wrong one. But anyway, so to see how the surface conditions have impacted on human materials. So I think that it's going to happen sometime. But until that moment, they're kind of, I think of them as orphans. So we sent these little robot entities out, like, to represent us, and then we left them there. We abandoned them. We forgot about them. It seems a little sad to me, and it kind of makes me want to find them again just to let them know that they're still part of our culture. They're still part of us in some way.
Your book is delightful because it is not all about the science, I want to say. The stories you tell are so literary. And the one that comes to mind right now is the idea of the stork and the babies and the moon and bird migration. It's just baffling to me to think that at one point somebody believed that birds migrated in the wintertime from Europe off to the moon and back. How would telling that story factor into what you want to convey about space junk?
Oh, that's a good question, because to us right here and now, the idea that people genuinely believed birds might migrate to the moon just seems ridiculous, doesn't it? And yet at one point that was a perfectly logical explanation for what happened in Europe for all the birds. It just like left and didn't come back. The story of birds migrating to the moon kind of happens at a sort of a cusp between the moon being a repository of hopes and dreams. It was often used in literature. Populations on the moon were often used as satire to be critical about what was happening on Earth. So the moon had a lot of sort of symbolic importance and was used in all kinds of different ways to make statements about the nature of life on Earth. The birds migrating to the moon, it was in the 1800s that evidence was finally found. You wouldn't have thought it would be that hard, would you? But they finally found evidence that birds went to other continents during the winter. They didn't go to the moon. But we're kind of looking at a moment where the moon is turning from this repository of human symbols to becoming a scientific object. It starts to become reduced from a place where the birds might fly in winter to a place that's characterized by equations that describe its orbit, by a certain mineral composition, by a geological history that includes early stages of volcanism and bombardment by meteorites. And it kind of stops becoming a place where almost anything could exist or almost anything could happen. And I think this is a really interesting period in our relationship to the moon. And the end result of this transition from a fantastical moon, which you can project any imaginary society or environment into, to something that is lifeless and dead. And that's very much how people in space industry think of the moon now. Obviously, there are plans to go and extract lunar resources to mine the moon for various reasons. And that's all premised on the idea that the moon is a dead world. So this is the end result of this kind of transition for how we think of the moon. And one of the things I'm working on at the moment, which kind of leads from the stuff I was talking about in the book, is why people are committed to the idea of the moon as a dead world and the ways in which it isn't a dead world. So there's lots of research at the moment on water cycles on the moon because people want to go and use the deep ice deposits at the lunar poles, water ice, so they can use it to make fuel, to support habitations, all kinds of things. There is a water cycle, it seems. And that seems to me to mean that the moon is not dead.
I'm wondering if this idea that the moon is dead isn't a way of just relegating that whole orb to the category of space junk itself.
That's a really insightful observation, Marcus. Yeah. Do you know, I think you're right. And once it's junk, it becomes salvageable or usable or, you know, you can, whoever claims it, and I shouldn't use the word claim because in fact no one can do that. It's against the Outer Space Treaty, but it's there to be used because it is discarded junk effectively by virtue of being perceived to be lifeless. So yeah, I think that is actually a factor in how the moon is being conceived. So thank you for that fantastic idea.
Well, it's kind of bumping it off a pedestal.
Yes, this is true. So it becomes, I mean, we still look at the moon from the surface of the Earth when we, you know, go outside at night, and its light is still ethereal and beautiful, and it arouses all kinds of emotions in people, and a lot of those are to do with romance and love, which I think is very charming. So that still happens. But the moon is also this place that we send robots to, occasionally people, and that we're planning to mine. So it has changed its character in popular discourse. And the idea, I mean, nobody's going to deny that we need the moon for tides. I mean, it drives so much of the terrestrial environment. But no amount of lunar mining is going to change its orbit or stop that from happening, fortunately. But, yeah, we have kind of collapsed all of those meanings into this idea that the moon is a bundle of minerals that can be assessed for its commercial potential and turned into a resource in the same way as a coal deposit on Earth.
I'd like to finish, Alice Gorman, with just a quick question about where did this all start for you? How young were you when you decided that you could dig for things?
I can't actually remember how old I was when I realized that space archaeology could be a real thing. It was about 20 years ago that I had a revelation that all of the things we called space junk that were orbiting above our heads were actually an archaeological record. And because as a child I'd always wanted to be an archaeologist, but I had also wanted to be an astrophysicist or an astronomer. And when I thought about space junk as something you could study for its what it meant about human culture, it seemed to me like it brought those two parts of my life together in a way that made sense to me. And I immediately abandoned everything I was doing at the time and started pursuing this as a thing. And now it seems that people are accepting that space junk is also archaeology and heritage, and that maybe we should think a bit differently about it.
Alice Gorman, I have enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me, Marcus.
Alice Gorman, she's a faculty member of the International Space University's Southern Hemisphere Space Program in Adelaide, Australia. And her book is titled Dr. Space Junk Versus the Universe, Archaeology and the Future. I guess we've really left a mess floating out there in space, and some of that mess could cause serious havoc down the road for astronauts or for satellites. And then there's the space junk that's just sitting still, motionless, literally parked, for instance, on the moon. Once the hottest ride anywhere to be found in the universe, these lunar rovers could now be rusting if there were just any oxygen in their parking lot. Get ready to take at least the topic of lunar rovers for a spin. You're listening to Constant Wonder. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. The broad category of space junk includes more than just orbiting debris and cast-offs. For some reason, the figure 17,000 miles per hour sticks in my mind when I think about their orbit. But a lot of space junk has been removed from circulation or fallen out of circulation, including the hulks of three lunar rovers, or moon buggies, if you want to call them that. The idea of a moon buggy, it turns out, was first proposed by German émigré rocket scientist Wernher von Braun in 1952. That was just a few short years after he was raining terror down on English civilians with his V-2 rockets. At any rate, von Braun's more peaceful vision, proposed in 1952, included not only a trip to the moon, but also a massive lunar rover. The idea was later revived by NASA, partly because the space suits worn by astronauts on the moon were too heavy, too ungainly, for them to do much exploration on the surface of the moon otherwise. We tend to think of the astronauts in 1/6 gravity as being light and airy, bouncing around like balls. But the truth is, the Apollo 11 astronauts really were not able to move around much at all. I got more on this story of the lunar rovers from Earl Swift, author of Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. We're going to drop in right now to hear what he has to say about the problem of mobility on the moon.
The suits they wore weighed more than they did. Most of that weight was in the backpack, which contained pumps and batteries and an air bottle and a water reservoir, and it supplied the astronaut with air and with cooling water as he moved around outside. But the suit itself, if you can imagine wearing a dozen raincoats one over the other and then pumping that heavy, unyielding garment filled with air so that it has the stiffness of an all-season radial and then trying to move around in it. Just to bend your arm took real effort. To close your fist around a tool was exhausting in just minutes. And so what looks like a lot of fun with the astronauts bunny hopping around was actually a very taxing labor. And that labor elevated their metabolic rates, which in turn prompted them to burn through their life support, the air and cooling water. So they could not, you know, it cut into the amount of time they could stay outside. And even if that hadn't been a factor, the fact is it just moving around was so cumbersome that they didn't move around much. The Apollo 11 astronauts, the farthest they ventured from their lunar module was 65 yards, and you could put all of their travels inside of a football field and have a lot of yardage to spare. You jump ahead 2 years to Apollo 15, and those guys drove 17 miles, and the rover conserved their life support by taking a lot of the labor out of going from point A to point B. I mean, the rover was a handful to drive, but it sure beat walking.
Do you suppose that Neil Armstrong was instructed, you're not going to be able to walk very far?
Well, I think they had a pretty good idea that it was going to be a taxing undertaking right from the start. But, when he and Buzz Aldrin got back, they had a technical debriefing and they met with the people developing the rover. And they acknowledged, you're good for maybe a half mile of travel without a rover. But they also expressed grave doubts as to whether a rover was practical. They envisioned something that would require, that would have wheels 20 feet in diameter. They had a different idea of how a rover would be used than of course NASA did, but just how tough it was. A lot of this, of course, could not be tested on Earth in any sort of accurate way. You're talking about wearing a suit from, inside your helmet. You can't see your own feet. You are exposed for the first time to the weirdness of 1/6 gravity for an extended period of time. And the way that affects the way you move, your balance. And then there's just the landscape itself, which is very disorienting. The sky is completely black. The horizon is weirdly close. And there are no yardsticks from which you can judge distance. There are no trees or clouds or houses or anything that we use without even thinking about it to judge how far away something is. And consequently, a crater or a boulder that was a pretty good size, but a long way off, looked exactly the same as a much smaller rock or a much smaller crater close in. And that, that's another layer that just added to the difficulty of the experience. Of course, it also made driving more of a challenge as well.
Earl, we were just about to return to the topic of those final three missions and the rover missions. So I guess we're talking Apollo 15 at this point?
Yes, we are, which touched down on July 30th, 1971. And the first rover drive occurred the day after.
So they just get it out of its package and they unfold it and they snap it back together and off they go?
Pretty much. It was designed to kind of unfold like a drawbridge from the side of the lunar module with a few tugs on lanyards and whatnot. And it settled on the ground. They had to attach some auxiliary gear to it, like the TV camera and the antennas. And then they were off.
Was it absolutely smooth? I mean, there were malfunctions.
There was a glitch on that first drive in which the front steering didn't work. So they went just with the rear steering, and the rover did fine. It had steering fore and aft. Other than that, it was, it went perfectly. They covered 6.3 miles, which was more than the travels on the three previous Apollo missions on the moon combined. Spent about 2.25 hours out visiting the edge of the canyon I mentioned earlier. They climbed up the side of a mountain, the size of Kilimanjaro. They collected a lot of rocks. It was a spectacular day, maiden voyage for the rover.
How was it powered? I'm just curious because clearly it's not going to be burning oxygen. Was it just fully electric?
It was. It had two batteries that drove four motors, one in each wheel. Each motor was 1/4 horsepower altogether. 1 horsepower of propulsive brawn, which is about the same as a weed whacker. But those motors were married to a really ingenious transmission that really gave it a lot of torque, a lot of muscle. It was capable, this wispy thing that weighed 460 odd pounds on Earth, 78 pounds on the moon, could carry twice its own weight. And it could do that climbing up the side of, 18, 20 degrees up the side of a slope. It was a tenacious, incredibly resilient piece of equipment, as it turned out.
So each mission got its own fresh rover. They didn't go back and reuse the old rovers?
No, they were, these landings were hundreds of miles apart. And of course, they couldn't bring the rover back with them. There was no place to put it. They only flew half of the lunar module back. So the rovers were left on the moon's surface, where you can still see them. You know, they're parked exactly as they were.
Yeah. So what do you make of the fact that this rover looks like a car? I think you've already alluded to this a little bit, the idea that it's connected with a technical artifact of America that has been just central to our culture, and there we take it to the moon. I mean, there's got to be some kind of meaning in all of that.
Well, there was certainly some wisecracking at the time that the most automotive people on the planet would send a car into space. You know, it was a foregone conclusion that we would, I think, in some people's minds. But the, you know, I think NASA saw the rover, and rightly so, as a spacecraft on wheels more than a car. It's a car at first glance. The more you study it, the more you realize it has nothing in common, or very, very little in common with the cars that we drive, or that we drove in 1969 for certain. It is a car that has been reduced to its indivisible minimum. This is something that is so stripped down, it's beyond stripped down. There's very little there. Its aluminum frame was an alloy that was chosen for its toughness and its lightness. Its seats were beach chairs for all practical purposes. You know, they were fireproof and Teflon coated, but they were beach chairs. And, you know, it could only be used in 1/6 gravity. It was that rare piece of NASA equipment that couldn't be tested on Earth before it was sent into space. So that first drive on July 31st, 1971 was its shakedown. I mean, it had not been tested before that.
Aside from demonstrating that it was possible, I mean, this was a serious scientific exploration, and the aim was to go gather samples of stuff and maybe to map out some of the terrain, I'm guessing. Would you address the idea that there was some concern from some parties that this thing wouldn't even be able to function because of the dust, or maybe the dust was so fine and without the gravity there, maybe the dust was really something more like a liquid sea?
Well, that was pretty early on. We're talking 50s to mid-60s that there was that sort of theorizing happening. By the time the rovers showed up, there had already been a couple of landings. Well, Apollo 11 landed before the contract was let, and Apollo 12 landed a month after the contract was let, actually about 2 weeks after. So at that point, and of course this is after our surveyor probes had landed and established that the surface was strong enough to support a spacecraft. By that time, that was not a concern. But early on, oh, you bet. I mean, there was a scientist named Thomas Gold who theorized that, the dust, this incredibly fine powdery dust that does in fact comprise the first several inches of the lunar surface, was thousands of feet deep, perhaps. And that led to many in the press to postulate that maybe a landing spacecraft would simply disappear into it. So there was worry going into the very first work, you know, exploration into a manned landing, but it was quickly dismissed.
Now, I don't know exactly what I would specify as the most important aim or objective in terms of retrieving materials, but it just seems to me like the overwhelming focus was about geology.
Absolutely. And that was a conscious decision. And you know, even back in 1952, when von Braun wrote that piece for Collier's magazine, in which he kind of laid out this whole model for a lunar visit, you know, he kind of leaned towards geology at that point because as he wrote in that story, the moon is uniquely situated to help us better understand Earth's history and that of the universe, because it's dead. It's been dead since infancy. It's inert. And unlike the Earth, which has a very dynamic surface, roiled by volcanism and tectonic movement and the effects of weather and whatnot. The moon has just been floating around in space, unchanged except by the effects of meteor strikes, and quite consequently, it's a time capsule from which we can learn a lot about how things were in the very earliest days of the universe's formation. And so the astronauts were up there to do serious science. They were well trained. By the time the Apollo 15 crew got there, they were extremely well trained in field geology. They were sent to specific places that were of scientific interest. There was a scientific back room at Mission Control that could look over their shoulders as they worked, thanks to the remote-controlled TV camera on the rover, and could give them suggestions. On Apollo 16, in fact, the back room asked Charlie Duke to pick up a specific rock that they had seen on the screen, and that he would not have picked up otherwise. The thing was the size of a football and weighed 26 pounds. But this was a different brand of scientific endeavor than had come before. Now, the rover opened up a whole range of possibilities scientifically, because now a spacecraft could land in the middle of an area that promised a lot of different kinds of geology, and it could reach, the crew could reach all of those places. That had not been the case before.
Well, if the scientific inquiry was facilitated to a greater extent by the rovers, I mean, just in terms of travel and ground covered, you mentioned the first Apollo 11, astronauts couldn't go much further than maybe within the scope of a football field. And then a total of something like 56 miles between the three rover missions accomplished, and gathering samples and bringing that back to Earth. All of that, if so much was accomplished by these rover missions, unriddle me this, would you? Why have we forgotten them almost?
Well, it's just, it's confounding. But I think that we, as a species, have a pretty, we have short attention spans. And the fact is, Apollo 11 was such a shared worldwide experience in the moment where we all watched this unfold in real time. And it was an almost unthinkable achievement for these two guys to be stepping onto another celestial body, that everything that came after was kind of, it was viewed as more of the same and not nearly as exciting. And very quickly, the Apollo program, and it's incredible to think of it this way now, but it became commonplace, it became yesterday's news. Now, the rover's arrival did reinvigorate public interest in the program, at least briefly. For the first couple of drives that Apollo 15's crew took Rover 1 on, there was great interest. For one thing, the TV transmissions of the rover's first forays across the Hadley Apennine region of the moon occurred at convenient times to watch TV on Earth. Their maiden voyage happened over breakfast on the U.S. East Coast. Their third drive didn't get much attention at all because it wasn't carried in its entirety on TV. And then by the time Apollo 16 came along, there was still wall-to-wall coverage, but people didn't tune in as they had. Again, they lost interest very quickly. Apollo 17 got interest mostly because it was the only nighttime launch of a Saturn V, which was a heck of a show. But the mission itself, which broke all records for science and exploration, the Apollo program, was as overlooked as its predecessors.
Do you anticipate we're going to get there again?
Oh, sure. Sure. I don't know when people will be going back, but as it stands now, NASA plans to send a rover back in 2023, an unmanned rover to the lunar South Pole to look for ice, for water. That program appears to be on track. A private company will actually deliver the rover to the moon, although the rover itself is being built by NASA.
It'll be televised, won't it? I'm sure somebody's going to have a camera on that thing.
I haven't seen a camera on the drawings I've seen, but I'm sure there is a camera aboard just so that they can navigate it. We'll be able to watch is another question.
Do you see any correlation between the vehicle moving across the surface of Mars and this lunar, I mean, it's like the granddaddy of what's happening on Mars in a way.
Well, it's interesting. There, I don't find a direct lineage between the lunar rover and the Mars rovers. But if you go back a few years into the kind of foundational rover work that General Motors was doing in Santa Barbara, back when it was looking at putting a remote rover aboard the Surveyor landers in the very early 60s, you will see a great resemblance between GM's six-wheeled prototypes and what we now have exploring Mars. Ferenc Pavlik, again, and his mentor, a Polish refugee named M.G. Becker, Greg Becker, developed a six-wheeled rover with a flexible frame that had the genes of a billy goat. It could climb over obstacles half again, almost twice as tall as its wheels. The 6x6 rover, because it had a flexible frame, always had its feet planted, all six of its feet planted on the ground, no matter how crazy that ground was. And if you look at the Mars rovers, they took the same idea, and instead of giving those rovers a flexible frame, their designers gave it a suspension that's not at all elastic, but it's separate from the body of the rover and can act independently of it, and it emulates a flexible frame. So it gets to the same end by a slightly different means, but it's very much the same idea.
Earl Swift is author of Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. We invite you to join with us here at BYU Radio in 10,000 acts of service. That's a goal for 30 days, and you can join the effort performing service, large or small. Great ideas available at justserve.org. That's an online resource, and you can discover volunteer opportunities by zip code. Justserve.org. May sound like something from a dystopian science fiction novel. Teenage girls falling asleep for weeks or months on end, needing to be fed by a tube, apparently in a coma, but they are not in a coma. There is no neurological explanation. What is going on with this phenomenon? Well, there's a line of thinking that it could be a social contagion playing out somewhere between the body and the subconscious. We're going to visit with a British neurologist who's looked into the matter Tuesday on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.